Welcome to episode 136 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. After a visit to Kyoto, which we talked about last week, the six of us, that's family and friends, went on to Hiroshima and visited the Itsukushima Shrine and the Peace Memorial Park. The park is situated under the hypocenter of the atomic bomb blast and houses numerous memorials, including the A-bomb dome, and that really is the main thing that we're going to look at today. Let's look at one shot from Itsukushima before we move on to a number of shots of the dome, and then a little bit of a discussion about the area itself and what it all really means. Itsukushima Shrine is actually situated on a small island that you have to get to by a ferry. To get the ferry, we took the tram from next to our hotel for about an hour. It's quite a long ride on the tram. And you go up to a stop called Miyajimaguchi. And Miyajima's the name of the island that has the shrine on it. Some of you will have seen photos of the Itsukushima Shrine, I'm sure. They have a torii, which is like a Shinto gate that sits in the sea in front of the shrine. The shrine itself is often photographed surrounded by water, but on the day we went, even when the tide was in at its highest point for that particular tide, we witnessed two tides. The tide was right in when we arrived, and then it went out and came back in again. But even with both tides at their highest points, the water didn't make it anywhere near even the frontmost pillars of the shrine that sort of, you know, stick down into the sand there. So it was never really totally engulfed by the sea. It's a nice shrine, but, very touristy, and without timing your visit to coincide with a big high tide, it's probably not going to be that photogenic. I didn't take any photos of the shrine itself, not even for posterity or whatever. On the way in on the ferry, I shot a few images there with the Shinto gate in the sea and the shrine behind it. But artistically, didn't really, they're not really much. That was just more for a memory of the day. So, by the way, if you ever visit Japan and get a JR rail pass, one of the Japan rail passes, which makes traveling here relatively cheap by comparison, you can also use the JR ferry for free. But having said this, it's only 70 yen, which is about 70 cents US. So it won't really break the bank. Also, if you do visit and you are not restricted by being with others, your main objective is photography, then I suggest that you make sure that you can stay on the island until sunset, because it sets probably, looking at the way it was going around the sky and the direction and everything, it looks as though it sets nicely across the mountains of the mainland behind the gate in the sea there. And I tried to do as much as possible with the gate under the circumstances, but I wasn't going to be able to stay there until late. So, really it was just sort of making what I could of the situation. I did try some long exposures though to smooth over the sea. And let's just take a look at image number 1766, in which we can see what I came up with. This is actually a 13-second exposure. I was using the Singray Variable ND filter, the neutral density filter, which basically is like a really strong PL filter, a polarizer or two, that allows you to sort of dial in as much darkness as you need. I find that it works well with the 70-200, which is the lens I was using it with on this day. I selected an aperture of f8 and I had the ND set to just about full, which blocks out about 8 stops of light. At its weakest, the Vari ND blocks around 2 stops of light, so it's good in that, you know, you don't have to carry around lots of different ND filters. Anyway, as I said, I basically smoothed the C over by using the Vary ND, and you can actually see some pebbles on the seabed there. And what I was doing was standing at the edge of where the waves stopped to shoot this, and the tide was on its way back in. So I was sort of constantly having to keep my eyes on my footing. A relatively uneventful shot, I think, but you know, should give you an idea of the place. If I ever get a chance to come back here, I'll definitely allow myself to stay until dark so that I can get a chance to get the sunset, which I suspect may even be possible to line up with the gate at certain times of the year, if not most, if you just sort of move around the you know, the beach there. I imagine that you're going to be contesting for a spot though as well. It's one of those things that if it's well known, I've never really researched this place because I didn't want to make myself feel bad because I wouldn't have time to do a lot of real photography here. I didn't research this, but it wouldn't surprise me if it wasn't a well-known thing, and you know, people often head over here for the evening, so that they can get that. So you probably will be vying for space on the beach. Still, it probably makes a nice place to come for a shoot. Well, we decided to leave late in the afternoon and let everyone have an hour in the hotel before going out for dinner. But another reason why I wasn't too worried about having forfeited my chance to get a sunset shot at Itsukushima Shrine on this particular day was because I wanted to pay my first visit to the A-bomb dome at the Peace Memorial Park. This is actually just one stop further away from the hotel that we stayed in. So me and the other half got off and let the other four go back on, you know, to the hotel. We arrived at around 5:30 p.m. and we had a bit of direct sunlight left. So I spent a few minutes walking around the dome and sort of, you know, seeing how I was going to approach the shooting. And also just to sort of reflect on it a little, because, you know, it is quite a poignant place to visit. And I've wanted to come for a while, so I wanted to just let it sink in that I was actually in front of this building. The first thing that I noticed from a photography perspective is that the front of the dome near the river that runs sort of directly in front of it, from that place, it's not easy to get a clear shot of the dome in its entirety, as the area behind the dome is pretty well built up. There are just sort of, you know, there's normal offices and shops, and I think probably in photographs that you look at from further away, you can probably see the hotel that we stayed in as well. It's a big high-rise building. But basically, you know, it doesn't make for a very good photograph from the front there. Unless you want to, you know, show up how built up the area is, I think it's probably better to avoid that angle. So the first shot in the series that we're going to look at today is image number 1767. As you can see, the sun was very close to the horizon at the end of the day, so I decided to use that to effect by positioning myself so that the sun shone through one of the windows in the center of the building, and use a fast enough shutter speed and small enough aperture to sort of darken it down a little bit and make a nice sort of silhouette. As you'll see in the next image, it was far from dark yet, but we can make a silhouette very easily with fast enough exposures and the small aperture. So let's just take a look at the details. I was using an aperture of f11 for 1/200th of a second with ISO 100. As I was pretty close to the dome, I used my 16-35mm f/2.8 lens, and I was using it sort of on the short end at 35mm. There was, of course, only a limited amount of time with the sun shining through the window, and you know, I got about three frames, as the sun was sort of moving across there. The trick is to get positioned with the sun just sort of coming into position, as it really does move quite quickly through such a small space. Then, you know, a few moments later, as the sun came fully through the slit in the window there, I tripped the shutter. Like I say, I got about three frames, but then it was really starting to move out the other side. I wanted lots of, you know, those trees there. There's two trees that we can see in the shot. So, you know, I shot quite wide like this, and I ended up sort of cropping about 15% of the left side of the frame. And this was partly because it wasn't adding anything, but more so because there were some buildings that were, quite obvious there in the distance, and they detracted from the shot. There's actually a few buildings in the bottom right too, but, you know, I don't think they stand out as much, so I left them. Next, let's take a look at image number 1768. This was shot some 17 minutes after the last shot, and yet it's still quite bright. This is the only shot that we'll look at that was taken from the front side, close to the river. I used the shift function on my 24mm tilt shift lens for this shot to correct the trapezoidal, I don't even know how you say this properly, but trapezoidal effect that we see when we look up at buildings. I was actually standing right next to the railing there in front of the building, just a few meters away. And I'd also set this shot up as I moved around with my 16-35mm lens, but it was quite badly distorted. And you know, that in itself is okay. And you know, they look for good shots, and it because we're used to seeing that trapezoidal effect, we know that that means that we're standing looking up at something. But here I basically, you know, I tried using the 24mm tilt shift lens to see if I could correct it some. And you know, basically what it does is it allows us to stop that sort of tilting inwards as the building sort of, you know, as we look up at the building. The tilt shift lens itself has a number of sort of screws and locks on there to move the lens around on the mount. The mount is obviously fixed, but you have a little switch that allows you to rotate it so that you can use the tilt and the shift features for horizontal, vertical, or even sort of any degree in between the two. Basically, if you haven't used one of these lenses though yourself, it might take a little bit of getting used to the idea of doing this, but it's actually a very old thing. A lot of the cameras from the very early days with the bellows on there allowed this to, you know, this action to be done. So it's not a new thing to photography at all. And indeed, the lenses, the tilt shift range from Canon are pretty long in the tooth now as well. So anyway, depending on whether or not you rotated the lens, what you can do is you can slide it up and down or side to side. And this is basically the shifting. And what this does is corrects that trapezoidal effect that I mentioned. And that's, you know, where buildings lean in as we look up at them. There is a second knob on the lens, though, that tilts the lens. And tilting basically moves the focal plane to any angle that you set it at away from being parallel to the film plane. And that's, you know, where it, you know, normally will be with a standard lens. You're always going to have the focal plane, the plane of your depth of field is always going to be parallel to your film or your digital sensor. But when you tilt a lens, it's moving that focal plane away from the same as your film plane. And this is handy for sort of laying sometimes very shallow depth of field down across an area of the scene that's not necessarily parallel to your camera's film plane. Say you were looking up at a rock face and you wanted to sort of, you know, it was very dark and you needed to use a relatively small or narrow depth of field, obviously wide aperture. Then you could sort of tilt the lens a little bit so that you made sure that the focus ran up the rock face. You can also use it, as I've done before, to lay the focus down across the heads of a field of flowers, for example. And, you know, these things are also, you know, they're very useful if you are using the lens for architecture as well, because you can sort of, if necessary, you can change the focus to also be in line with the straightening of the perspective of the building and everything. It can also be used for artistic effect, though. I mean, this is one of the things that's being used a lot these days. to make kind of a miniature effect. You know, everything looks like a model, a small model of basically what's a normal scene. And I actually went into detail about this lens and this surreal effect in episode 13, though, way back when. So if you want more information, maybe you can go back and listen to that episode. Back to the image that we were just looking at, though. You can see that the building is now reinforced with metal bars inside. If you peer in through the open windows there, you can see metal bars that are holding it up. There's been a certain amount of work done to fix cracks in the facing cement as well. And it's not doing too bad, though, to say that it was the closest building to still be standing following the horrific blast on August 6th in 1945. The exact point of the blast, called the hypocenter, was about 150 metres or 500 feet away. And it was, basically, as I say, this dome is the first building from that hypocenter that was standing. It was debated as to whether or not the building should be pulled down. And, in more recent years, it's just it's been debated as to whether to just let it fall down. But it was decided to do sort of just enough repairs to stop it from falling down and keep it as a peace memorial. The building itself was actually designed by a Czech architect named Jan Letzel, I would imagine it's pronounced. And it was built in 1915. At the time of the bombing, though, it was it had been used for various things, and it was at the time of the bombing was being used as an industrial promotion hall. After shooting a little more, we went back to the hotel for a short while, and then 30 minutes before we were due to be back in a bar for this night's session, I was back in front of the dome after dark, shooting image number 1769. I wanted to shoot the building at night as well as during the day, as I believed that they illuminated it. And I don't really know if this works, but I tried converting this image to black and white by reducing the saturation of all the channels in Lightroom. And I then tweaked the luminance of each channel to bring out some details in the brickwork. But then, wanting a little something more, I raised the saturation of the blue channel just slightly again to put a touch of colour into the sky. And I found this interesting, but not entirely sure if it really works, so maybe you can let me know what you think in the gallery or in the forum at martinbaileyphotography.com. I shot this with my 24-105mm f4 lens, by the way, and the aperture was f8 for 20 seconds at ISO 100. Next, let's take a look at image number 1771. Here I haven't messed with the colour, apart from the white balance, so that the building has just a bit of a green cast from the lights. It was pretty bad to begin with, but I cut it back to just this amount, and the lights inside of the building are giving off a nice sort of warm orange glow. The building actually originally came back to this wall that we can see in the foreground here. All but the front section and the dome and the smaller wall around the building was demolished, though, in the blast from the bomb. I shot this with the camera in portrait mode, but then chopped most of the top of the image away as it wasn't really adding anything. I called it a day here, basically, and I went back to meet the family at the a nearby eatery that we decided on before I went back to shoot at the dome that evening. The following day, we were all going to spend the day in the Peace Memorial Park looking at various memorials, and we planned to take a steady look around the Peace Memorial Museum. We entered the park from the corner with the dome. It was the closest to the hotel. So let's look at one last image from this morning before I tell you a little bit more about the park and its various memorials. This last image is number 1773. Again, with the tree in front of the dome, I was shooting with the 24-105mm f4 lens with an aperture of f8 for 1/40th of a second with ISO 100. I was shooting at 32mm, so I could have also used my 16-35 f.2 lens, but both are, you know, nice sharp lenses, and the 24-105mm is more versatile, which is very welcome when you're basically having to be a tourist with family as opposed to a photographer. I don't remember whether or not I tried shooting with a PL filter. It's been sort of more than a month since I shot these images, and I can't remember if I used a PL. But the sky was pretty pale, so I decided to convert this shot to pure black and white, which enabled me to bring out a bit of contrast between the sky and the clouds. I also like black and white here, just because it's kind of a, you know, it's obviously a sad monument, and you know, I think that this picture itself with the dark tree there even looks a little bit sinister. So, you know, the building itself was almost too warm and bright in this morning light as well, and I didn't really think it matched the tree. As I said earlier, the dome is on the edge of the Peace Memorial Park, which it contains a number of other memorials. After walking further into the park on the morning following the last shoot, one of the first memorials that we visited was the Children's Peace Memorial. This was built after a young girl called Sadako Sasaki died from a form of leukemia from radiation exposure from the bomb. Sadako folded 1,000 cranes in paper, and basically she was hoping that it would cure her. You know, it was kind of like a way of focusing her attention and all of her sort of her inner strength to try and get rid of the illness that was basically killing her. Now, following that, in Japan, children across the country group together to fold 1,000 cranes when they wish for something. And there are some small glass boxes, sheds or outhouse sort of things that they have near this children's memorial. And it's basically there are, you know, just thousands and thousands of folded paper cranes from all over the country that have been sort of built into pictures and other writing as well. And they're all sent here, maybe brought here, as, you know, basically just to keep the whole thing in memory. There had been instructions from the local government, at the time of the bomb being dropped on Hiroshima, there had been instructions from the local government to tear down strips of houses in the city centre to act as fire breaks, as they feared that they might be bombed, as a conventional bombing. And when that happened, because the houses in Japan are often made of wood, they didn't want the fire to spread across the city without anything to stop it. So they were creating fire breaks. And many people had been driven from their homes. And the most tragic part of this is that it was mostly young children that were being used to tear down the houses and to clear away the rubble to make the fire breaks. And they'd all just about arrived for work when the bomb exploded at 8:15 a.m. Obviously, that means that, you know, many children were either burned instantly or subject to, you know, severe burns. When I say burned instantly, I mean just blown away, disintegrated. Or they were left with severe burns, which killed them in the coming hours or days. Or like Sadako, they were exposed to radiation. Even if they survived the blast, they were killed in the coming months and years. The park also has a cenotaph for Korean victims, as there were many Koreans that had been brought into Japan to work, and I believe many of them against their will. But basically, the bomb didn't understand nationalities or age or anything. It just tore through Hiroshima, wiping most everything in its path off the face of the earth. Surprisingly, there were survivors, and there were many reports of the horrors that followed. Apparently, after being exposed to radiation, and also as many people were suffering with severe burns, they made the way to the river, the same river that I was talking about that flows past the front of the dome. And when they got there, as well as bathing their wounds, many took a drink. And when you drink with severe radiation poisoning, apparently your insides turn to a kind of sherbet and you obviously die pretty much instantly. Because of this, the river that runs across the front of the dome through the city was awash with bodies. Some said that there were so many bodies that you couldn't see the water. There are also reports of people's skin, you know, people walking around with their skin that's melting like wax and just dripping off of their bodies as they walked around trying to either find their loved ones or just, you know, in a hell-like delirium. In total, by the end of 1945, some 140,000 people had died either in the blast or in the months that followed it. I didn't take photographs of many of the memorials except the dome. And the memorial, I did take another photograph, well, two of the memorial cenotaph in the center of the park. I didn't post any photos of the memorial cenotaph, though, as I only really photographed it for my own memory of the visit. It was quite a poignant time, and, you know, walking around the park, I was quite moved by much of what I saw, and the memorial cenotaph, you know, through which you can see the dome, by the way, in the distance there. It actually, in the cenotaph, they have an epitaph, and it has an inscription that says, "Rest in peace, for we will never repeat the mistake." Notice that, you know, the word "we" in this sentence doesn't really mean "we" as in the Japanese, and it doesn't mean the Americans, it doesn't mean anybody. It's totally non-judgmental and really means "we" as in the entire human race. The peace memorials here are to keep the horrors of the bomb from fading away in time. There, you know, a lot of the people that were that witnessed the bomb are, you know, they're all sort of in their 70s, 80s, and obviously they're dying. There's not, you know, it's not going to be long now before there are no generations that actually witnessed the bomb still alive. So it's important, I think, you know, obviously. The people of Hiroshima and Japan think as well that it's important to keep it alive. And, you know, they're not in any way being judgmental. As I said, they're a reminder of the horror and the futility of war in general. If you're ever in Japan, please do try to make your way to Hiroshima and spend a day in the Peace Memorial Park. One of the main thing, other things to do here that I haven't mentioned yet is that there's a large museum here, and it has lots of information on the bombing and the years that followed. There are also a lot of actual you know, items that were recovered from the wreckage, such as bottles, stacks of bottles that had sort of melted together, and there were roof tiles that are, you know, although roof tiles are you know, they're hardened in a kiln that gets to pretty hot temperatures, and there's actually roof tiles that had melted in the intense heat. It costs just 50 yen to get in, and that's, again, it's like 50 cents US. And I forget the exact price, but for a few dollars, you can also rent an audio guide in many languages. You basically get a little device with headphones that it allows you to listen to the information on all of the exhibits. You can, you know, pause it, fast forward, rewind, do whatever you want. So it's pretty cool. I actually have no problem reading Japanese. I read probably almost as fast as I do English, which is not that fast. So it's nothing to brag about. But, you know, I basically decided to read my way around. But my family had, they did rent the English audio guides and said that it was pretty good. Whatever your background, though, wherever you come from, you know, the horrors are real. And if you're human and you have a heart and a thinking mind, I think that you really would, you know, appreciate what happened here. I think it's worth a day out of a holiday here if you do visit Japan at any time, to see for yourself what it must have been like to have been on the receiving end of one of just two atomic bombs that have been used in war in the history of the world. So, a pretty sullen note there. You know, I hope that you enjoyed the photos of the dome and the little bit of information on the peace memorials. I'll put a few Wikipedia links into the show notes so that you can read up yourself on some of the history and information about this historical and touching place. Remember that the abstract assignment is still in progress, and I'm seeing some great image being posted. So, you know, you can post your entry until the end of May 19th, and then I'll start the voting system for 2 weeks after that, and then we'll find out who the winner is. Thanks for all your well wishes too over the last week. Some of the that visit the forum will have known or read that my 1DS Mark III fell ill and had to be hospitalised for a week. I was getting a few errors, an error 99, which basically means that the camera doesn't really know what's going off, or it knows what's going off, but it doesn't think that it'll help to tell us. Maybe 3 weeks ago I was out, and a couple of times I saw this error 99, so I had to sort of turn the camera off and on again. And didn't really think too much of it at first, but then a week later, I was out, shot about 200 frames, and during those 200 frames, about 20 times, the same error appeared, and I thought, this is not good. I took it into the service center in Ginza here in Tokyo, and they basically said that they didn't know what it was, they needed to take it in and take a look. So I left it with them on the Monday, and it was actually an extended holiday here. It's Tuesday night now, but Tuesday and Monday were holidays, so it was a 4-day weekend, and I was hoping to get out and do a little bit more photography. So I'd prodded them a little bit and asked to do it as quickly as they could. They usually say 10 days. They actually said it wouldn't be back until the 13th, but they got it back to me much earlier than that. I did get it back on the Friday after the Monday. I took it in, and I'm pleased to say that having shot a good a few days worth of images, I haven't seen the error again. Apparently the camera keeps a log of errors. So, like I say, I don't know if they're just not showing us what the problem is, but they were able to, although they weren't able to reproduce the issue, they were able to identify the areas of the camera that were probably at fault, and it was some lever assemblies, apparently. The log helped, and it looks as though they fixed the issue. So thanks for Canon. Not so much of a thanks for building a professional camera for $8,000 that breaks in 6 months, but I guess we are pushing the limits of the technology a little bit, so understandable to a degree. Anyway, I'm happy that it's back, and thanks again, like I say, to all of those that were rooting for me. So that really is it for this week. I guess that all that remains to be said is you have a great week, whatever you do. Bye-bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.